This is the Disability News Program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm John Curry, your volunteer reader. Thank you for joining us. Today's program will include an article from Psychology Today entitled, How to Thrive in Your Body When Living with a Disability. We'll also have a piece about a recent U.S. Supreme Court decision in an important school disability case, as well as the latest from the Disability Scoop and other articles as well. Let's get started. First up is a piece from Art Daily, published June 18, 2025. It's entitled, Nara Rosler, New York Presents On Blindness, An Exploration of Poetic Vision Beyond Sight. New York, New York. Nara Rosler, New York is presenting On Blindness, a group exhibition curated by Mateus Nunez that explores the phenomenon of blindness as a poetic catalyst. The exhibition's concept arises from the intersection between literature and the biography of Jorge Luis Borges, 1899 to 1986, the Argentine writer who lived the last three decades of his life in blindness. Featuring a wide range of artists from different generations and backgrounds working across various media, including painting, sculpture, drawing, photography, and video, the works explore the possibilities of artistic and poetic experience beyond vision through obscure, excessive, metaphysical, tactile, and minimal sight. On Blindness brings together historical works by artists Agnes Martin, Armando Riveron, Robert Mapplethorpe, Antonio Diaz, Myra Schendel, Milton Resnick, Tommy Otake, Brigida Baltar, and Leonelson. Key works by established artists include Carlito Carvalhosa, Fernanda Gomez, Paolo Monteiro, Jack Lanier, Don Vo, Solange Pessoa, and Bernardo Ortiz, and emerging voices such as Paula Siebra, Juliana Frontin, Ben K. Voss, Hyoa Travisan, and Tiago Hotner. While drawing from the experience of biological blindness, particularly through Borges' life and literary work, the exhibition centers on the idea of poetic blindness, which can be seen, for example, in The White Phase of Venezuelan artist Armando Riveron, 1889 to 1954. During this period, Riveron synthesized the representation of light into near monochromatic compositions dominated by white. He created these white landscapes that, while referencing the intense sunlight close to the equator, also engage with the medium of painting itself, the raw canvas as image, in a play between painted and unpainted areas, comments the curator. Light and the use of the blank support as the body of the work are also central to Untitled, 2022, by Fernanda Gomez, born 1960, which features two square canvases in slightly different shades of raw linen placed side by side. A projected square of light intersects them, generating a third square beneath. In contrast, Milton Resnick's Last Elephant, 1979, a large-scale painting by the American abstract expressionist, is rendered in dense, dark materiality. The varying tones of black generate an optical hum across the surface. According to Nunez, blindness can be understood as a conceptual tool within the context of Latin American modernity, helping to dissolve Eurocentric categories in art. The act of not seeing, or of seeing indistinctly, relates deeply to the exercise of imagination, a key element in the development of Latin American magical realism. This literary movement, which emerged in the 20th century, blends fantastical elements with realistic contexts, and Borges, who became blind, is one of its foremost figures. Within the realm of blindness, imagination operates ambiguously. While the blind person imagines what the sighted person sees, the reverse also occurs. Imagination, then, centers on the formation of images beyond the visual. Poetic blindness is also present in one of the show's highlights, a photograph by Robert Mapplethorpe, 1946 to 1989, of painter Alice Neal, 1900 to 1984, who has her eyes closed. This work opens the exhibition as it shows a painter who saw so much and produced so many images, now with her eyes closed, in a moment of spontaneous temporary blindness. I am interested in this maze of ambiguities. The image depicts someone who creates images, and it's also made by an image maker, the curator notes. The idea of imagining or proposing alternative forms of visibility is one of the exhibition's core themes. Japanese-Brazilian artist Tommy Otake, 1913 to 2015, explored non-pathological temporary blindness in her well-known blind paintings. Created between 1959 and 1962, these works were painted with her eyes covered as she attempted to attune her gaze to a blind spot in order to immerse herself in the act of painting. Brazilian artist Paulo Monteiro, born 1961, contributes bronze sculptures painted in white oil paint, which embody what the curator calls tactile visibility. The pieces bear the impressions of the artist's fingers and hands on the clay that served as the mold for the bronze forms. Meanwhile, works by Canadian painter Agnes Martin, 1912 to 2004, challenge the automatic association of horizontal lines with landscape, guiding the viewer toward introspective visual experiences. Swiss-Brazilian artist Myra Chandel's Graphic Objects series, 1919 to 1988, and the black and white paintings of Brazilian artist Antonio Dias, 1944 to 2018, establish a dialogue between blindness and language, demonstrating how the two exist within the same uncertain threshold. Matheus Nunes is a Brazilian curator, art critic, and researcher. He holds a Ph.D. in art history from the University of Lisbon. He has completed postdoctoral studies in art and architectural history at the University of São Paulo and in Amazonian studies at Universidade San Francisco de Quito. His writing regularly appears in publications such as Artform, Art Review, Flash Art, Freeze, Moose, and in academic journals. He is currently assistant curator at the São Paulo Museum of Art, MASP. Next up is that piece from Psychology Today entitled, How to Thrive in Your Body When Living with a Disability. A new book, You Are More Than Your Body, offers empowering strategies for body acceptance by Paula Friedman Diamond. Published June 10, 2024. In You Are More Than Your Body, 30-plus evidence-based strategies for living well with chronic illness, Dr. Jennifer Caspary blends insights and tools from decades of clinical experience and a lifetime of personal experience living with cerebral palsy to help readers develop a more empowered, grounded relationship with themselves and their bodies. Every one of us has the potential to feel disconnected from our bodies and buy into beliefs that our bodies are problematic, ugly, or wrong. However, people living with chronic illness or disabilities are bombarded with this message to a greater extent in ways both implicit and explicit. Dr. Caspary offers a different perspective. What if you can change your relationship with the parts of yourself that make you different from others? What if, instead of trying to simply put your head down and hope nobody notices your differences, you could practice unconditional self-acceptance and then refocus your energy on pursuing your values? I found the resources and insights offered to be incredibly valuable and an important reminder to appreciate nuance. The reality is that our society does not treat people with disabilities with the respect and kindness that every human being deserves. Dr. Caspary describes how experiences of discrimination and being othered can be incredibly painful, but the way you respond to those experiences can be healing and resilience building. She describes many ways in which her cerebral palsy pushed her to build grit and determination and enhance her capacity to experience empathy. This doesn't mean that you should be happy or unbothered by those experiences. It means that while you can't choose whether or not you have a disability or chronic condition, you can choose what that condition means to you and how you speak to yourself about it. You can choose where you direct your energy and attention and how much you emphasize or focus on any single aspect of your experience in any given moment. You can also choose your behavior or how you respond to the situations you're faced with. I strongly resonated with the acceptance and commitment therapy, ACT, and mindfulness practices the author presents to help facilitate the reader's movement toward healing and self-compassion. I appreciated her framing of emotional vulnerability as a skill that can be practiced and developed. We don't often think of vulnerability as a skill or tool, but it is. It allows for greater honesty with oneself and deeper connection with others. I work with people with chronic conditions and appreciate how she framed the grieving process as ongoing and continuous, since reminders of losses or new losses pop up at every phase of life, sometimes over and over again. Things that aren't available to you because of your disability or differences. She speaks of how living with a disability has created more pain and put her at a disadvantage in many regards, but it has also shaped who she is and enhanced existing values and qualities. There is an overall emphasis throughout the book on post-traumatic growth and resilience factors. The author shares several personal examples throughout the book, which helped me as the reader to follow her lead in being willing to connect with the more painful parts of myself. I also think that by using herself as an example, she highlighted how the journey of self-acceptance is not linear and doesn't have a finish line. Even after years of work, she still struggles with the natural ups and downs of being alive and the self-judgment and frustrations that we can all relate to. Perhaps my favorite question posed by the book was, how can I be my authentic self within the reality of this moment? The idea of living authentically can be slippery, since authenticity is subjective and depends on the moment and situation. Taking the context into consideration and asking yourself, what's authentic to me right here, right now, takes an ongoing process of curiosity and self-reflection, but the result is a more meaningful and grounded way of moving through the world. Overall, I highly recommend this book for anyone living with a disability, chronic health condition, or simply a lifetime of treating their body as the enemy. I believe anyone can benefit from Dr. Caspary's message of radical self-acceptance and values-guided living. The book is available from North Atlantic Books. And now from the New York Times, Supreme Court sides with teenager in school disability discrimination case. Disability rights groups have followed the case closely, warning that arguments by the school district could threaten broader protections for people with disabilities. By Abby Van Sickle. Published June 12, 2025. The Supreme Court on Thursday sided with a teenage girl with epilepsy and her parents who had sued a Minnesota school district, claiming that her school had refused to help her receive as much instruction as her peers. The case hinged on what standard of proof was required to show discrimination by public schools in education-related disability lawsuits. In a unanimous decision written by Chief Justice John G. Roberts, Jr., the court held that the student and her family needed to show only that the school system had acted with deliberate indifference to her educational needs when they sued. That is the same standard that applies when people sue other institutions for discrimination based on disability. The school district argued that a higher standard, a stringent requirement that the institution had acted with bad faith or gross mismanagement, should apply. Had the district prevailed, the new standard might have applied broadly to all kinds of disability rights claims filed under the Rehabilitation Act and the Americans with Disabilities Act. That argument had unnerved some disability rights groups, which had cautioned that a ruling for the school could make it much harder for Americans with disabilities to successfully bring court challenges. As a result of the ruling, the student will now be able to press her case in lower courts. The Chief Justice wrote that although the decision was narrow, it was critically important for children with disabilities and their parents. Together, they face daunting challenges on a daily basis, Chief Justice Roberts wrote, adding that the court decision meant that those challenges do not include having to satisfy a more stringent standard of proof than other people who bring court challenges under federal disability rights laws. The case, AJT versus Osseo Area Schools, number 24-249, stemmed from a dispute over whether the district near Minneapolis had provided reasonable accommodation for Ava Tharp, whose severe epilepsy made it hard for her to come to school and participate during regular hours. After Ava's family moved to Minnesota from Kentucky, her parents requested that she be able to receive instruction in the evening because of her disability, as she had in Kentucky. The family said in court filings that the school district notified them that it would not be able to accommodate the request, which meant that Ava received only 65% of the instruction time of her peers. A federal judge had sided, in part, with the school district. The judge concluded that under the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Rehabilitation Act, federal legislation that requires public entities and organizations that receive federal funding to provide reasonable accommodation for people with disabilities, the Tharp family was required to show that the school district had acted with either bad faith or gross misjudgment. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit upheld that ruling, and the Tharp family appealed to the Supreme Court, arguing that the courts had applied the wrong standard. They pointed to several other appeals courts that had applied a lower standard of proof in such cases, requiring only that the school had showed deliberate indifference to her needs. In their petition to the court, lawyers for the family argued that the case presented an exceptionally important issue for children with disabilities and their families, and that educational discrimination often has life-altering consequences for children with disabilities. The lawyers said that the case raised one core question: whether children with disabilities who brought education-related discrimination cases were required to meet a more stringent test than others who sue under federal disability laws. It is inconceivable that when Congress enacted laws to combat disability discrimination, it silently singled out school-aged children, perhaps the most vulnerable subset of people with disabilities, for disfavored treatment, lawyers for the family argued in a brief. The school system urged the justices not to take the case, arguing that the system had reasonably responded to the disagreement about the length of Ava's school day by making persistent efforts to address the situation. The district added that although Ava's parents disagree with some decisions the district made, the family's frustrations did not evince discriminatory intent under any standard used in any circuit. In a brief to the justices, the school district also raised concerns about the broader implications of a ruling in favor of the family, raising fears that it could usher in a flood of similar claims, subjecting every public school in America to federal court supervision, plus the potential loss of federal funding and money damages. And now here's another article regarding a U.S. Supreme Court case, this one from military.com. It's entitled, Supreme Court Rules Unanimously Against Time Limits on Combat-Related Disability Pay, by Patricia Keim, published June 13, 2025. The Supreme Court ruled unanimously Thursday against the federal government in a class action suit over combat-related special compensation, paving the way for an estimated 9,000 retired service members to receive thousands of dollars in retroactive pay. In a 9-0 ruling, the justices said that a law the government applied to limit retroactive pay to 6 years did not apply in the case of a Marine corporal who sought combat-related disability pay. Simon Soto enlisted in the Marine Corps in August 2000 and served two tours in Iraq in mortuary affairs. He developed post-traumatic stress disorder as a result of his job and medically retired in 2006. In 2009, he was awarded disability compensation for his medical condition by the Department of Veterans Affairs, and in 2016, he applied for combat-related special compensation, pay that is awarded to some service members who retire as a result of a service-connected medical condition. He was approved, and his pay was backdated to July 2010, based on the interpretation of a law known as the Barring Act, which requires veterans to file compensation claims within 6 years of receiving a VA disability ratings decision. Attorneys for the government argued that Congress established the 6-year deadline for the submission of claims and said combat-related special compensation decisions should also be limited by 6 years. But the U.S. Supreme Court disagreed, saying the law regarding combat-related special compensation displaces the Barring Act's 6-year time limit, so the Barring Act did not apply. The Federal Circuit erred by imposing undue requirements on Congress's ability to confer settlement authority and by disregarding the combat-related special compensation statute's plain text, wrote Justice Clarence Thomas in the opinion. The decision means that Soto should receive 2 more years worth of payments dated to January 2008, when Congress extended the combat compensation to medically retired members who served fewer than 20 years. At least 9,000 service members also may be entitled to additional retroactive pay. Class members in the Soto case include veterans who are owed up to $10,000 in back pay. Members in a separate case, Page versus USA, include those owed more than $10,000. The Page case was placed on hold pending the decision in the Soto case. The class was represented by Sidley Austin LLP on a pro bono basis and the National Veterans Legal Services Program. During an interview with Military.com, Renee Burbank, director of litigation at National Veterans Legal Services Program, said the financial impact of the decision is not yet known, given the variety of cases and application dates for the benefits. No retired service member can receive retroactive pay before the passage of the 2008 law, however. If you do a back-of-the-envelope estimate, if the average amount of money each class member is entitled to is $5,000, and let's say there's about 10,000 people in both classes at this point, because obviously time has moved on, that's about $50 million, Burbank said. It's not huge for the government, but it's meaningful for the class members. The Supreme Court has made several significant rulings regarding veterans' benefits in the past 2 years. Notably, in a case that awarded veterans who served separate stints in the U.S. military additional education benefits based on their service under separate GI bills. The decision in Rudsill v. McDonough may have affected up to 1.7 million veterans. Two officers who would benefit from the decision have sued the Department of Veterans Affairs, however, saying that the VA is improperly denying benefits and delaying payments. Burbank said the unanimous decision by the Supreme Court in the Soto case sends a clear message that veterans who qualify for additional retroactive combat-related special compensation should receive it without question. There's not wiggle room for the government to say, well, actually, here's why these folks don't get paid. And also, because it's a class action, this relief should be going directly to all the class members. It's not one case, Burbank said. Our next article comes from the Disability Scoop. The title, White House Sued Over Accessibility, by Sean Heasley. Published June 17, 2025. Disability advocates are suing after the Trump White House abruptly stopped including sign language interpreters at press briefings and other events. The National Association of the Deaf filed a lawsuit late last month in the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia after the group said its repeated requests for American Sign Language interpreters went unheeded. The federal complaint alleges that the lack of interpreters is a violation of Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act and the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. The White House's failure to provide qualified ASL interpreters during public press briefings, press conferences, and related events is against the law, the complaint states. Federal law unequivocally prohibits discrimination against individuals with disabilities and requires them to have meaningful access to the federal government's programs and services. Failing to provide ASL interpreters deprives deaf people of meaningful access to the White House's press briefings. ASL is distinct from English, with its own grammar and structure, and closed captioning is insufficient for many ASL speakers, the group said. In addition to the National Association of the Deaf, the suit was filed by two deaf individuals who said they have difficulty understanding closed captioning. This is not the first time the group has gone to court over this issue. In 2020, a federal district court ordered the White House to provide interpreters for all coronavirus-related briefings. Subsequently, a policy was put in place to provide ASL interpreters for press briefings conducted by the President, Vice President, First Lady, Second Gentleman, or the White House Press Secretary, the National Association of the Deaf said. Under the Biden administration, the group said that ASL interpreters were included in all public briefings, press conferences, and related events by the President, Vice President, and Press Secretary. But that changed when President Donald Trump took office in January. Deaf and hard-of-hearing Americans have the right to the same access to White House information as everyone else. Denying them ASL interpreters is a direct violation of that right, and the NAD will continue to fight for their full inclusion in the democratic process, said Bobby Beth Scoggins, interim chief executive officer of the National Association of the Deaf. Such information must be provided not only through captioning, but also in American Sign Language. The lawsuit names Trump, White House Chief of Staff Susie Wiles, and Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt. The National Association of the Deaf wants to see ASL interpreters included at any White House press briefing and other public events and visible in broadcasts of such events. The White House did not respond to a request for comment about the lawsuit. You're listening to the Disability News Program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm John Curry, your volunteer reader. Next, we have another piece from the Disability Scoop, this one entitled, Program Gives Students with Intellectual Disabilities Full College Experience, by Maddie Aiken, Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, Pittsburgh. Adam McChesney wanted a traditional college experience, but with autism spectrum disorder, McChesney believed he had limited options. That was until McChesney learned about Rock Life, a four-year program at Slippery Rock University for students with intellectual or developmental disabilities. After 4 years and school trips to London, a national park, and Pittsburgh sporting events, McChesney earned his Rock Life certificate from the state school in May. He was one of 18 students enrolled in Rock Life this spring. What I like about Slippery Rock and Rock Life is that it gave me such an amazing opportunity to make friends, said McChesney from Warren. I got to do a lot of fun activities. I got to be in many clubs. I got to go on field trips. I took advantage of that. Slippery Rock's non-degree certificate program gives students such as McChesney the opportunity to earn college credits, socialize, and adapt to independent living. The program began in 2016 as part of the university's commitment to being an inclusive institution, said Rock Life director Natalie Burick. She'd like to eventually grow the program's enrollment to 25 or 30 students. A lot of times, students with disabilities are not able to go on to a college program. This gives those students the opportunity to earn some credits and to also develop social skills and independent living skills while participating in campus life, Burick said. Our students can have the full college experience. McChesney's full college experience included attending classes, living in campus dorms, and participating in plenty of extracurricular activities. Rock Life students choose which courses to take alongside their Slippery Rock peers. For McChesney, that meant studying theater, music, and early childhood education. McChesney also participated in musical theater society, film society, early child education clubs, and SRU Marching Pride's drumline. He even performed at the 2024 London New Year's Parade alongside his bandmates. Rock Life students are also encouraged to work at least two semesters. McChesney worked at child care centers at the university and in his hometown in Warren. And Rock Life students are buddied up with a peer coach, a fellow Slippery Rock student, during their time in the program, said Burick. All of this aims to give the students an immersive experience. There are 20 total higher education programs in Pennsylvania specifically catered to students with intellectual or developmental disabilities. In western Pennsylvania, other programs include Compass at Duquesne University, Bearcat BEST at St. Vincent College, and RISE at Westmoreland County Community College, though Rock Life is the only program in the region to offer housing for student participants. During Slippery Rock's commencement, graduating Rock Life students are honored with their certificates and thunderous applause. "It's the most emotional and uplifting part of the ceremony," said Slippery Rock spokesman Justin Jackal. McChesney carried the Rock Life gonfalon at the ceremony. "Graduation was bittersweet," he reflected. "It's tough to say goodbye, but I'm ready to move on," he said. "I have mixed feelings." Looking to his future, McChesney would like to work in early childhood education. "Numerous Rock Life students have worked in that field and restaurant management," Burrick said. But thinking about the long term, McChesney dreams of becoming an actor and representing autism on the stage. Slippery Rock provided him with experience in both of his fields of interest. "Someday, I'd like to be a professional actor in theater or even in motion pictures," he said. "There aren't a lot of actors who are considered to have autism in a lot of movies. I just thought, why not make a difference?" Now a piece by Michelle Diament entitled, "NIH Launches Major Autism Research Initiative," published June 16, 2025. The National Institutes of Health is making $50 million available to study autism. But many researchers in the field are leery of the new initiative, which they say is rushed and skirts typical protocols. The effort, known as the Autism Data Science Initiative, aims to use data from a variety of sources to help understand what causes autism and what's driving increasing prevalence of the developmental disability. In addition, projects will work to understand how existing treatments and interventions are used in order to guide the design of future studies. Federal officials say they expect to provide up to $5 million each for 10 to 25 projects through the initiative that will last 2 to 3 years. ADSI is intended to bring together diverse data resources, researchers, and community members to further our understanding of autism and develop new knowledge that can be used to improve health outcomes for people on the autism spectrum, Doug Sheely, Deputy Director of the NIH Office of Strategic Coordination, said in a webinar about the effort. The NIH said that projects through the new initiative could rely on data sets from a wide variety of resources, ranging from Medicaid and the National Survey of Children's Health to genetic data from the Autism Speaks MSSNG database, and many more. Applications must include a community engagement plan describing how people with autism, their families, caregivers, clinicians, service providers, advocacy organizations, or other stakeholders will be involved. What's more, the announcement said that data used will comply with privacy and confidentiality requirements under federal and state laws, as well as policies from the NIH and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Despite the large amount of money available, many researchers in the field are skeptical of the funding announcement that was released in late May, which they say is out of the ordinary in several ways. Notably, the NIH is using what's known as an other transaction funding mechanism for the Autism Data Science Initiative. This approach gives NIH staff significantly more control over projects than is typical, according to Helen Tager-Flusberg, director of the Center for Autism Research Excellence at Boston University and founder of the Coalition of Autism Scientists, a group of more than 250 researchers in the field. The OT permits far greater involvement of NIH staff. For example, they can require independent funded investigators to collaborate, take the data sets generated by the funded investigators, and conduct their own analysis. Choose to stop the funded project before the end, she said. it opens up the possibility of NIH staff using an investigator's data for purposes that were not intended by that investigator, either for themselves or providing the data to other groups. In addition, Tager Flusberg noted that NIH staff will be involved in the peer review process, something that she said is unheard of for standard grant applications. And the initiative calls for just one level of review, as opposed to the typical two-step process that involves scientists and community members. The Coalition of Autism Scientists wants to see the NIH commit to an independent external advisory board of autism scientists and community members for the Autism Data Science Initiative. Researchers have until June 27 to submit proposals for the initiative, a much quicker turnaround than usual. Another concerning issue is the rapidity with which the process from announcement to the application submission deadline is taking place, allowing just 1 month for applicants to pull together a large-scale collaborative scientific proposal, said David G. Amaral, a professor at the UC Davis MIND Institute. The funding announcement comes after the NIH said it partnered with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to access data on Medicare and Medicaid enrollees with autism to establish a real-world data platform to allow research across claims, electronic medical records, and consumer wearables. However, NIH officials said that the Autism Data Science Initiative is separate from the data platform. While both are data-focused, the agency said that the Autism Data Science Initiative is a research initiative, while the real-world data platform will establish a new infrastructure to study chronic disease, and autism will serve as its initial case study. Autism researchers are facing financial pressure, with data showing that federal funding for autism research was down 26% during the first 4 months of this year. Officials with the NIH and HHS did not respond to questions about the Autism Data Science Initiative. And now, a piece entitled Gymnastics Team, a World Leader in Inclusion, by Annie Main, Marietta Daily Journal, published June 17, 2025, The Disability Scoop. Marietta, Georgia. For nearly 50 years, gymnasts have practiced their cartwheels, splits, and tumbling routines in an old purple barn off Canton Road, just northeast of Town Center Mall. It's hard to tell from outside the gym, which is identified only by large, faded lettering, but the Cobb Club is one of, if not the only, age, ability, and gender-inclusive athletic teams in the world. Chattooga Gymnastics was started in 1976 by Cindy Bickman and her parents, Tom and Brownie Beaver. It was a true family operation. Tom built the gym, Brownie did the books, and Bickman was in charge of coaching. Bickman said inclusion wasn't an express goal for Chattooga, but became a reality after a deaf gymnast joined the first team and the demand for ability-inclusive teams became immediately apparent. By 1987, Bickman became the gymnastics coach for the Cobb County Special Olympics team, and Chattooga was the de facto gym for any Special Olympian in the metro area to train in. Chattooga is the most inclusive gym in the country, possibly across the globe. It is the most inclusive one, said Minora Shinohara, former Georgia State Chairman of USA Gymnastics. Shinohara said other gyms, particularly those that offer the more advanced rhythmic gymnastics, have a near militant training style. At Chattooga, he said, it is more like a family. That familial aspect stems partly from the fact that many gymnasts spend decades training here. Karen Davis was 12 years old the first time Bickman coached her on the 1987 Special Olympics team. Now 49, Davis still practices with Bickman weekly. Paulette Harrison, 59, started coming to Chattooga when she was 19, and Lanny DeMello, 39, has spent 20 years training in the barn, which she calls her second home. These are girls that have grown up with this program, Bickman said. The family feeling also comes from the multi-generational team makeup. Several parents and even grandparents participate in team performances. Tournaments and showcase performances have taken the team all around the world, from South Africa to Switzerland, Finland to Brazil, and most recently, Germany. Roughly 20 Chattooga gymnasts of all ages, genders, and abilities traveled to Leipzig, Germany in late May for the world's largest gymnastics festival. The first U.S. team to be invited to Turnfest, Chattooga performed alongside gymnasts from Sweden, Germany, Lithuania, Greece, and Slovakia as part of an international inclusion team. Bickman said theirs was the only performance to receive a standing ovation. All the members of the team had people coming up to them when they were walking down the street, when they were eating at restaurants, Bickman said. It's nothing that Chattooga gymnasts aren't used to by now. Several have risen to national, even international acclaim, like DeMello and Shannon Laffey, who have both held Down Syndrome World Championship titles. The team was recognized with a proclamation from Commissioner Kelly Gambrill last month, has been the muse for several songs by the German pop band Herzgold, and is the subject of an upcoming feature-length documentary by filmmaker Trish Giovanni. I have documentary ideas all the time, and I talk myself out of them. I couldn't talk myself out of this one. I was hooked, Giovanni said. People are drawn to Chattooga for different reasons. For parents who have children with disabilities, it has long been the only place that would accept them. The first time I called, I spoke with Cindy, and I said I wanted to find a class where they would be able to work with her because she had special needs, Lucia Barra Sparkman said. Lucia Barrera Sparkman said of the decision to bring her daughter, Mary Lynn Collins, to Chattooga. And I'll never forget. Cindy said that all her coaches would work with Mary Lynn. Any of them. Any day, any class. And I've never looked back. So Mary Lynn's been here forever and will always be here. For parents whose children do not have a disability, Chattooga is a place where their kids can grow their gymnastic skills and learn a lesson about inclusion. This is a very special place, very, very special, what they do here. We are the ones included, said Sylvana Ford, whose 12-year-old daughter, Abby, a Simpson Middle School student, has been on the Chattooga team for 2 years. In the rest of society, you are including special needs individuals to whatever program you have. However, here, we are the ones included. Bickman has never doubted her Special Olympians, unafraid to enter them in any competition. That first one in Germany, competition officials didn't know they had special needs. I just entered them against the national teams of all the Eastern European countries. We kind of stole the show, Bickman said. Team members haven't always been greeted with open arms. I remember taking Paulette to a restaurant down the street and people laughing at her in the bathroom when we first started, Bickman said. And now that doesn't happen so much. People are used to seeing people who are different. Bickman said sweeping changes to bring inclusion into gymnastics, including a new rule allowing Special Olympians to compete in any USA Gymnastics event, are a testament to a changing culture. So many places, when we started doing this, people would turn away these kids and not allow them into their program, and mostly because they didn't know what to do with them, and they were afraid that they weren't equipped to handle them, Bickman said. But once we go, everybody invites us back. And this next piece is entitled Teen's Patent-Pending Invention Was Inspired by His Uncle with Cerebral Palsy, by Sean Krofsik, Hartford Courant, Hartford, Connecticut. Nolan Koskukiewicz did what any teen might do when they learned their invention had been nationally recognized. He celebrated. It was crazy. Right when I heard Super Flipper, everyone went crazy. It was so amazing, Nolan, 13, of Newington, said. It just means so much to me. The John Wallace Middle School 8th grader qualified for the 2025 Invention Convention U.S. Nationals held at the Henry Ford Museum of American Innovation in Dearborn, Michigan in early June. He won the category for Household Organization and Appliances. He found out the good news about his invention, the Super Flipper, at a recent ceremony. The invention is a type of spatula. Nolan's win was under the Industry Award category. Koskukiewicz needed to advance to state and regional competitions before qualifying for the U.S. Nationals. In all, more than 202,000 students from kindergarten through 12th grade participated in Invention Convention worldwide programs, and 490, including Koskukiewicz, made nationals in Michigan, according to the program. Steve Koskukiewicz, Nolan's father, said Nolan had submitted the idea for Super Flipper in 2024 to earn him a selection in 2025. It gives you a year to refine a prototype and data and get ready for the competition, Steve Koskukiewicz said. The idea for the Super Flipper came from Nolan after being inspired by his uncle Paul, who has cerebral palsy. It's a lever-driven spatula. The user would press on the lever and the spatula spins 180 degrees. Steve Koskukiewicz said his son is on the second prototype now and will be on his third for the product in the next few months. In all, this project is 18 months in the making so far. It's patent pending right now, and by the end of next January, we will be in a provisional patent state, Steve Koskukiewicz said. We have a year to finalize the design and drawings. We're working with a couple of different manufacturers now. Steve Koskukiewicz said his son is on every manufacturing call throughout the process and that he is interested in quality and not quantity when it comes to manufacturing. Steve Koskukiewicz said his son's love for inventions comes from the side of his mother, Jen. Her late father was also an inventor. He invented 11 medical products. Jen Koskukiewicz is a special education teacher at E.C. Goodwin Technical High School in New Britain, and Steve works at Mobility Works in East Hartford. Nolan has an inventing table in the basement where he is always working, Steve Koskukiewicz said. This could not have been a better finish for him. He has worked so hard over the last year, and pre-orders keep coming in. Nolan Koskukiewicz said the notion for the Super Flipper came to him after 4 months of thinking of ideas, and it took another 6 to 7 months to get to the phase of his first prototype. He was continually getting feedback from his uncle. It's a way for me to show my creativity and ideas to other people, Nolan said. This award displays my desire to help others. I can invent things to help others. This shows how important it is to me. Kaskoukouits will be starting at Xavier High School in Middletown in the fall. According to a statement about the 2025 Invention Convention U.S. Nationals, more than 75 awards, including cash prizes, trophies, medals, and patent applications, were presented. This is the 10th year this event has taken place. That's it for today's program. This is John Curry, your volunteer reader. Thanks for tuning in to the Disability News here on SunSound. Please join us again next time and enjoy all the programs here on SunSounds of Arizona.